If I ask you, the books of Ezra and Nehemiah tell about. Do you know what they tell about? If we'd say Ezra and Nehemiah, what do they tell about? Well, they tell of Israel's return from Babylonian captivity. And that's where we'll be studying tonight, looking at Ezra, particularly at Ezra tonight. And so you might want to take out your pew Bibles and or your own Bibles and open it up to the book of Ezra. Now, if you cannot figure where Ezra is, find the book of Psalms and back up three books. Will that help you find it? That's a good way to find it. It's the last of the historical books that give the details about all of this. How long were they in Babylonian captivity? Well, I hope you know the time of that, and that is about 70 years. And so if you have fixed in your mind some historical date of 606 is the day when Daniel was taken into captivity and the Babylonian captivity started, you take away 70 years from 606, and so the date of this is 536 B.C. What happens? Well, the verses that were read said, in the first year of Cyrus, you got Ezra chapter 1, verse 1, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus. And so the question that's in your manual, in your field manual is, who is that king of Persia who issued a decree that the Jews could return from Babylonian captivity? And the answer is Cyrus. Now look carefully at this and look down in the verse that says, the Lord commanded me. That's in verse 2. How did the Lord command him? Well, in all likelihood, it comes from those verses and the closing verses of Isaiah 44 and the beginning verses of Isaiah 45, where there, Isaiah, 750 B.C. I want you to hear that now. Isaiah, 750 B.C. mentions the name of a man who is going to reign in 536 B.C. That's 200 years, more than 200 years before Cyrus ever comes onto the throne, and almost 200 years before he was ever born. God called this man Cyrus by name, and he says, God says of Cyrus, the Persian king, he's my servant, and he'll do my will, and he will be the one who causes Israel to go back. So in all likelihood, it's when these words were showed to Cyrus. Could you imagine the impact? If somebody showed you a book that was written 200 years before you were born that mentions you by name and tells what you'd be doing. Cyrus evidently saw that. And so Cyrus said, God commanded me to go rebuild that temple in Jerusalem. And that's what we're reading about. You see, all prophecy is history written before it happens. Now you and I are at a loss to do that. Only God knows the future. But God knew that 200 years down the road, a man by the name of Cyrus would be born and he would issue the decree. And so Ezra chapter 1, Cyrus sends this out, this decree, to look in verse 2, to all the kings of the earth. Thus says Cyrus to all the kingdoms of the earth. Now, underscore that and recognize that the northern kingdom was not over in Babylonian captivity. They'd been taken up to Nineveh, to Assyria. They fell to the Assyrian kings, you know, in about 720 B.C., roughly. And so here is this decree that goes out, and it goes out to the entire world. And that's why, and you need to get this, that's why when they came back from Babylonian captivity, it was not just Jews from the southern kingdom that went back. When we get a little bit later in the study of what happened there, you'll find that they offered sacrifices for all 12 tribes. And so it was not just those from Babylon that came back, but the decree went out to the entire world. And so there were Jews who came back. But the decree of Cyrus says, who is there among you? Look in verse 5. He let him go back. And verse 4 says, who is left in any of his places that desire, that does not desire to go back, let him provide the money that they might go back. And so in verse 5 and 6, there were those heads of the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, priests and Levites, with all whose spirit the Lord had moved them, and they all around them, verse 6, encouraged them with articles of silver and gold and goods and livestock. So the times come about for the return from Babylon captivity. But not everybody went back. I was trying to create in my own mind a situation. It might be a parallel to understand what 70 years of captivity had been. They didn't want to go back. Why? Because of those who were young, they had never lived in Jerusalem. They were born over in that land. They'd been over there 70 years from the time that Daniel was taken captive. What was happening, 70 years ago? Well, one thing that I could think of, and those of us in South Florida could relate, provided that you have some age on you, and that is Batista, the ruler of Cuba. I wonder, could I have a show of hands that anybody that remembers Batista? Look around, young people. Your parents of the teens probably don't remember Batista at all. 50 years ago, more, a little over 50 years ago, he was overthrown by Castro. Now I want to know, add 20 years to that. How many of individuals who fled from Cuba 50 years ago and add another 20 years to that, how many of those Hispanic people living in South Florida would have any desire at all to go back to Cuba? There's your geographical parallel to that. 70 years they've been in captivity and they don't want to go back. And it's possible that the population of Jerusalem had been, hundreds of thousands. The population of Judah, 70 years whenever the captivity started. The population might have been 500,000, perhaps even up to 1 million people who were in that city. Do you know how many individuals came back? Well, here is the decree. If you don't want to go back, send the money. Then Cyrus himself made his own contribution. Look in verse 7 through 11. Cyrus brought out of his possessions, out of his treasury, the articles that Nebuchadnezzar had taken. Wait a minute. Nebuchadnezzar is from Babylon. Yes. Cyrus is from Persia. That's not Babylon. That's of the Medes and the Persian kingdom. And so Nebuchadnezzar has taken the gold articles from Jerusalem and they're still there. But they're not in Babylon. They're now in the treasury of Cyrus over in Persia. But they've been kept distinct. And so, verse 7, he brings out those things out. And the names to whom they're given is found in verse 8. And the number of them is found in verses 9 through 11. Of the vessels that were there in Jerusalem. And so now the people have made their contribution. King Cyrus has taken the holy vessels that were there that Nebuchadnezzar had taken. And they're all sent back by the hands of Zerubbabel. Chapter 2, verse 1. These are the people of the provinces who came back from captivity, of those who had been carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and who returned to Jerusalem. These are the ones, verse 2, that came with Zerubbabel. Now look at that list of names of those who returned. And we got down to verse 64. The whole assembly together was 42,360. Now there's some others mentioned a little bit later, but the slide on the screen says who led that first return from Babylonian captivity, and the answer is Zerubbabel, and the number that is given there is about 50,000. 10%, roughly 10% came back. You remember the word to describe those who would come back from Babylonian captivity? The words to describe them was a remnant shall return. And if the population had been 1 million, we're talking about 5% of those who had any ties at all back to Jerusalem. But wait a minute, they've been over there 70 years. Most of those who came back had never even lived in Jerusalem. The faith manifested by these 50,000 individuals is remarkable indeed. Let me see if I can illustrate. If Daniel was a teenager when he went into Babylonian captivity, if he'd been 15, 16 years of age, and now he's been over there 70 years, how old is Daniel? Well, 15 or 16 plus 70 means he's in his mid-80s. He might have been even 90 years of age. And so that you start thinking about of those who came back, some of them were individuals who were there before the temple was destroyed, you know, in 586, whenever the temple was destroyed, but not very many of them. And so now there are about 50,000 of them that go back. Some of them, they're not even sure if they have a right to go back. And verse 63 says, "And the governor said to them that they should not eat of the most holy things till a priest could consult," and there's that expression, "with the Urim and the Thummim." Does that ring a bell at all to what Urim and Thummim is? When we studied the book of Leviticus, we learned about the priestly garment, and there were two stones called the Urim and the Thummim that are mentioned occasionally in the Old Testament. And this is the last time they're mentioned in the Old Testament. They're not mentioned, to my knowledge, in the New Testament at all. And so they would have a question to ask of God, and God, by the use of two stones, the Urim and the Thummim, would give them an answer in relationship to this. How this came about and how these were used is really a matter of speculation. The number that came back in verse 64 is 42,000. Verse 65 mentions some 3,337 others who came back. And then there were 200 singers who were men, male and female singers that came back. And then in 66 you have the listing of the number of horses that they had. Chapter 3. When they arrive there, when the seventh month has come, the people assemble together to worship God. So they've been back about 7 months. And they began to worship God. That's found in the first three verses of that individual. They offered the burnt offerings and the sacrifices. The latter part of verse 3 said, "From morning until evening." Let me show you something interesting down in verse 7. In verse 7, they also gave money to the masons and the carpenters and food and drink and oil to the people of Tyre and Sidon to bring cedar logs from Lebanon over to the sea, to the Mediterranean Sea, and they would brought down from Phoenicia, Lebanon, the northern aspect of the land just north of Palestine, and they cut these large trees down in Lebanon, brought them over to the ocean, and took them via the Mediterranean Sea. All of that distance, more than 100 miles from up at Lebanon, from Tyre and Sidon, all the way down to Joppa. Now when they arrive at Joppa, they're at sea level, but Jerusalem is 3,000 feet in elevation. And so these trees from Lebanon, the mountains of Lebanon, these massive cedar trees that were there, were cut down, transported down to the ocean, sailed, taken down the Mediterranean Sea, more than 100 miles, and then transported from Joppa seacoast to the city of Jerusalem, 25, maybe 30 miles away from the seacoast, maybe even a greater distance than that, to be used to rebuild the temple. That is remarkable in and of itself. And those who have an engineering mind, and to see your mind turning about how did they transport them and everything, it's remarkable, isn't it, that they brought the cedars of Lebanon. Verse 6, go back to verse 6. From the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer sacrifices, although the foundation of the temple had not yet been laid. And now they began to make provisions for the temple to be rebuilt. And the task that was given, the task of Zerubbabel upon the return to Jerusalem, the task that was given him was to rebuild the temple. Verse 8 says, in the second month of the second year of the coming to Jerusalem, Zerubbabel and the captives of the people began to oversee the work of the house, and the builders laid the foundation in verse 10. The priests stood in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals and to praise the Lord. According to the ordinance of King David, they sang responsively. And here's the song that they sing, saying, He is good, His mercy endures forever toward Jerusalem. Singing responsively means that some would sing and the other would sing in an echoing kind of fashion, somewhat like we did in some of the songs we sang tonight, where there were some singing, then the others were singing shortly after that. And they're singing a song, God is good, God is merciful. And all the people shouted, verse 12 says, many of the priests and the Levites and the heads of the fathers' houses, old man who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this temple was laid before their eyes. Yet many shouted aloud for joy. And so there was weeping and there was joy, both emotions of those who were weeping and those who were shouting with joy. But no sooner do they begin to rebuild the temple, chapter 4, until opposition arises. You read here about those individuals who were adversaries of those, when they heard that the temple was being rebuilt, they came to Zerubbabel and said, let us help you build, for we seek your God as you do, and we sacrifice to him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here. Zerubbabel and Joshua, the high priest, and the rest of the people said, you may not do anything with us, because you're not worshiping God in the way that God wanted them to be worshiped. They had combined paganism with the worship that was there, and so they refused to offer help. Verse 4 said, the people of the land tried to discourage the people of Judah. And so these adversaries, to try to keep that temple being rebuilt, verse 5, hired counselors against them to frustrate them. They're there to rebuild the temple, and the people in that land have no desire at all for these Jews to rebuild that temple. In the reign of Ahasuerus, they send a letter back and they write accusations against the Jews, and the letter arrives back in Persia. Look in verse 11. Here is the copy of the letter that was sent to him. To King Artaxerxes, from your servants, the men beyond the river, meaning the Euphrates River, and so forth, let it be known to the king that the Jews who came up from you, who have come to Jerusalem, are building the city, and this is a rebellious city, an evil city, and they're finishing its walls and repairing the foundations. Let it be known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and the walls are completed, they will not pay taxes, they will not pay tribute or custom, and the king's treasury will be diminished. Now, because we've received support from this great, from the palace, from King Artaxerxes, it was not proper for us to see the king dishonored. Therefore, we've written to tell you, do not let this. If you will search your records, you will find that it is a rebellious city. Look in the middle of verse 11. Harmful to kings and provinces, and we inform the king that if this city is rebuilt, the walls are completed, the results will be that you will have no dominion over this city. The king sent an answer, and he says to them, peace, etc. The king that you sent unto me, the letter which you've sent unto us has been clearly read before me, and I give commandment, and a search has been made, and it was found that this city was a rebellious city. Therefore, verse 21, give command to these men that they cease rebuilding the city. Now, you've got to put yourself in the place of this remnant who's come back from Babylonian captivity. They have left Babylon. They've given up their heritage. They've been over there 70 years, and they go back to Jerusalem to do right. And the more they try to do right, the more frustration they have. Brother and sister in Christ, can you identify with this? Here they are trying to go back and reestablish the holy place and the most holy place, and there's nothing but problems that await them. And so the king had given the commandment, and now another king is on the throne, and he says, stop the work. Would you have stopped? Isn't it so easy for us whenever we're trying to live right and do right, when we meet a little bit of opposition, to throw up our hands and say, I quit? Well, in verse 5, there are two kings, or two prophets, chapter 5, I mean, verse 1, Haggai and Zechariah. Two of the books of the old, two of the minor prophets. They stir up the people to keep building this temple. And so rather than stopping it, though the decree has been sent to them to stop it, they do not let up very long, for Haggai and Zechariah stir up the people. And verse 2 of chapter 5 says, Zerubbabel and others began to build the house. Now there's one of these adversaries mentioned by name in verse 3 that come to the Jews and said, what on earth are you doing? What do you mean building this temple? Then accordingly we told them the names of the people who were constructing the building, but the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, so they could not make them to cease. So now another report goes back, this time to another king by the name of Darius. So we've got Cyrus, we've got Artaxerxes, and now we've got Darius. And so, or Darius, however you want to pronounce that. And this is the letter that goes back to Persia. And he says, I went out and I asked them, tell me by whose authority you're rebuilding this city. Verse 8, let it be known to the king that we went to the province of Judea to the temple of their great God, which is being built with heavy stones and timbers being laid in the walls. And we asked those elders and spoke to them, who commanded you to build this? We asked them for their names, so we could send back a decree to Persia so you know who the troublemakers are. And here's the answer. You want to know our names? We are servants of God, of the God of heaven and earth, and we're rebuilding this temple that was built many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and completed. That's in verse 11. But because our fathers provoked the God of heaven to wrath, he gave them into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. However, verse 13, Cyrus, the king of Babylon, issued a decree, and he gave us, verse 14, these gold articles, and he said, verse 15, take these articles with you, go back and rebuild the house on its former site, the latter part of verse 15. This same Sheshbazzar, which is another name for Zerubbabel, came and laid the foundation, which is in Jerusalem, from that time even unto now. It's been under construction and it's not finished. Now therefore, if it seems good to the king, let a search be made further to find out if Cyrus ever issued this decree. Now, do you know anything unusual about the laws of the Medes and the Persians? It's found over in the book of Esther, a book we have not studied. But a characteristic of the law of the Medes and Persians is, once a decree has been made, it cannot be changed or revoked. And so the precedent of this first commandment that came from Cyrus could not be modified because Artaxerxes was not aware of that first commandment. And so Darius issues a decree, chapter 6, verse 3, and he says, here is that which Cyrus gave. Now therefore, he says in verse 7, he sends this message back to the governor, verse 6, verse 7, let the work of this house of God alone, let the governor of the God of the Jews and the elders build this house. Moreover, I issued a decree as to what you shall do for the elders for the building of the house. Let the cost be paid at the king's expense from taxes that you guys have paid. Isn't that remarkable? Whenever there is adversity in your life and you think, I think I'm just going to quit. Don't you dare let up, because God is greater than that adversity. And so here the Jews are, and they've met with frustration. They've tried to rebuild the temple. The people in the land have sent a letter back to Artaxerxes, and Artaxerxes, at the response to that letter, said, stop the work on the city. They wouldn't stop. I cannot help but just remind you of the fact that it is always right to do right, and it's right to rebuild this temple. And they wouldn't stop. They kept right on working. And so now another letter goes back. And finally the message comes back that says, let this temple be rebuilt, and let the taxes of you people who've been the opposition to the building of this temple, let your tribute help pay for this building. And so, verse 13, there is the governor and their companions diligently did according to what the king had said. So the decree was found by Cyrus. Go ahead and finish it. Do it diligently. And chapter 6, verse 15 says, it was finished in the 6th year of the reign of King Darius. And so they've come back from Babylon. They've tried to rebuild it. They've met with opposition. Cyrus was no longer on the throne. Artaxerxes was on the throne. Artaxerxes is no longer on the throne. Darius is now on the throne. And now in the 6th year of his reign, the temple is rebuilt. The children of Israel, verse 16, and the Levites and the rest of the captivity celebrated the dedication of this house with joy. Verse 19, the descendants of the captivity kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. Why that date? Because that's what God had specified, and the temple had been rebuilt, and everything had come right. I was hoping tonight we'd be able to get over to the life of Ezra, but it's already 7 o'clock. In chapter 7, there is this second individual that comes back, and that is Ezra. The first group that came back came under Zerubbabel, and about 50,000 of them came back. Now, after these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, whom some think must be Artaxerxes II, though some seek to identify him with the Artaxerxes we've already read about in the previous chapter, that he comes out of Babylon, and with him about 1,800 other Jews return. And that's where we'll start up next week. Who led the second return from Babylonian captivity? And that is Ezra. As they went to Babylon captivity three different times. First, when Daniel was taken captive with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then when Ezekiel and others were taken captive, and then finally when the city was destroyed. So they come back at three different times. There are three leaders of the return. There is Zerubbabel, found in the first six chapters of the book of Ezra. Then there's the work that Ezra does from chapter 7 through chapter 10 in the book of Ezra. And the third leader is Nehemiah. So as you think about the history of the Old Testament, you've got the Jews disobeying God, going to Babylon for 70 years, and now they are returning. And we are historically at the end of the Old Testament. All we've got left to talk about is the return of Ezra and Nehemiah, which we'll do next week, and then the historical aspect of Esther, who's over in Persia, the Jewish princess who becomes a queen over in Persia. And then we've just got the last three books of the Old Testament: Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. So we've got a lot to look at to finish up this study of the Old Testament. And we may have one or two other prophetical books. I'm not sure if we've covered every one of them, but we'll be doing that. So we just have to put a little parenthesis here. Put in three dots here, three periods, and say, and next week we'll take up right at this point. What do we learn from all of this? Well, first of all, God cannot lie. God said 70 years in Babylon, and 70 years later they return. I think it's remarkable. He said 430 years they'll be in Egyptian captivity, and they came out exactly, precisely on the day, 430 years to the day later, they came out of Babylonian captivity. God cannot lie. I'll tell you what else we can learn. That God will always help us do His work. There is no restraint with the Lord to save by many or to save by few. A handful went back. The thing we have not pointed out is that when they got back from Babylonian captivity and they arrived there in Jerusalem, nobody wanted to live in the city of Jerusalem. I want you to think about a city that has been in ruins for 70 years, or for sure, you know, most of those 70 years they're in ruins. And so when they get back, as we'd say when I was a kid, they drew straws to see who got the short straw, who usually would be the winner. But when they got back, whoever drew the short straw when they cast lots, he was the loser, because the city was in such ruins. Nobody wanted to live in the city. Everybody wanted to go out in the villages surrounding it. Had it not been for this righteous remnant, Jesus could not have been born. God would have worked out some other plan, but we owe an unbelievable debt to people who knew about the will of God and the plan of God, and who left their homeland. Because now they're over in Babylon and over in all parts of the world, and they go back to a land where most of them had never, ever lived. We owe a debt to these people. God will always help us do His work. God keeps His word. We need to persevere in doing His will, and God will always bless us when we do what's right. And now we come to that part of our service where we sing this song of invitation to provide opportunity for those who need to be baptized into Christ, because they believe in Jesus and because they've made up their minds to follow Him, that based on the faith that they're not ashamed to proclaim, they can be washed in the blood of the Lamb when they are immersed in water. If you haven't done that, that's what you need to do. If you're an unfaithful Christian and you need to come home, you need to come home right now. As together we stand and sing. Will you come?